The second case for oral argument this morning is Robert Larson and Joel Penny appellants versus Michael Johnson Construction Appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Charles Dorothy, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Michael Tobin, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Mr. Dorothy, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Your Honor, Mr. Tobin. This appeal raises three important issues in the area of equity known as restitution. The objective of restitution is to prevent unjust enrichment. The first question is, what impact should the plaintiff's fault have on the plaintiff's right to an equitable judgment? The answer to that question involves the application of the equitable doctrine of unclean hands to the facts of the case. The equitable doctrine of unclean hands states that a person is not entitled to equitable relief if that person, one, was significantly at fault in causing his own injury, two, was not fair and honest in his dealings with the other party, or three, was not honest in the presentation of his case to the court. If the fault of the plaintiff, Your Honors, was dishonesty, either in his dealings with the defendant or in his dealings with the court, it should be a complete bar to equitable relief. If the fault was negligence or breach of contract, and it significantly contributed to the plaintiff's own injury or economic loss, it should be a complete bar to equitable relief. This is analogous to contributory negligence being a complete bar to recovery in negligence cases. It is analogous to the defense in breach of contract cases that plaintiff's breach was so substantial that it relieves the other party of the duty that would otherwise exist to complete the contract.
Do we have to do a weighing process like contributory negligence to determine whether it's slight or more than slight, or is it an all or nothing proposition, or where does it go?
That's an excellent question. I think, Your Honors, that the concept of being slightly contributory negligent barring you is too harsh. And when you're putting on your equity hat, I don't think you should go that far. I think that the issue should be whether or not the fault substantially contributed. And, of course, that's probably a jury question, or at least a question for the judge. But I don't think that this insignificant fault shouldn't deny you the right to equitable judgment. But if you significantly contributed your own injury, I think it should. I don't know that there's a weighing, but there certainly is a differentiation that has to occur as to how significant the fault was. The more significant the fault, the less the person has a right to seek equity from the court. I believe that you should use your decision in this case to emphasize to the bench and the bar that the equitable principle that one must not have significantly contributed to his injury, but one must have dealt fairly and honestly with the other party and with the court, are not just, it's not just a decisional tool that you can reach into your bag of decisional tools and say, here, I'm going to use this to decide the case. It is a threshold question. It is a first element in any equitable relief. You must prove that you have clean hands. You must prove that you dealt fairly and honestly with the other party. You must prove that you were not dishonest in any way in dealing with the court or with your opponent. You must prove that you did not substantially contribute to injury. If you don't get over that first element, that first hurdle, then you have no right to have the court use these extraordinary powers of equity. I think that you need to clarify that issue for the bench and the bar. so that every time an equitable decision is asked for, they know that is the threshold series of questions that needs to be resolved. Now, in this case, Mike Johnson's fault is so substantial that he is not entitled to equitable judgment. His fault is not only dishonesty in the terms of the invoices he created, but reducing nothing on the invoices for rock that he later admitted that he got and sold at a profit. He substantially contributed to his own injury. How? He left the job half done. Two different times over a year and a half, Bob Larson asked, well, when are you going to come back and finish? He never comes back and finishes the job, leaving rocks all over this guy's farm. So Joel Penny contacts Bob Larson, says, I see you got rocks all over your place. You know, I'd sure like to take them off your hands. And Bob Larson says, let me check with the guy that was supposed to be doing this. He goes down to his office, talks to his secretary, says, please call me. Tell me what your intention is in terms of finishing the rocks. And he just ignores him. He contributed so significantly to his own economic injury that he did not have a right to seek the exercise of equitable powers by Judge Foley.
Now, is that true with... Now, you represent two parties.
Yes.
Is that... Are you arguing that same concept as to both parties, or is there a difference between the two?
The difference between Mr. Penny, who's the farmer that also did rock work and came up and got the rocks, and Mr. Larson, who's the farmer who's placed the rocks, were... The differentiation, I think, between those two parties comes when we deal with the measure of restitution. How were they unjustly enriched?
The true discussion between the parties that with that you represent, only one of those parties really had any dealings with the other side, correct?
That's correct.
With Johnson.
And it ultimately is going to lead into my next issue, Judge. And let me state that and then follow up. The second question is, if the plaintiff's fault is not so substantial as to deny the right to equitable judgment, I mean, you find that there wasn't unclean hands, what impact should the plaintiff's fault have on the measure of restitution to be applied to the claim? The answer to that is set forth in Restatement of Restitution, Section 155.1. And it says that where the recipient of a benefit was not at fault or was no more at fault than the claimant, the proper measure of restitution is the value of the benefits received and not the cost of the benefit provided. Now, let me focus in on your question, Judge Mahoney. Bob Larson had rocks on his place that were detriment to him. He had some of his rock removed, but not all of his rock removed. And there was drain field put into a lower lying area that helped drain his field. But the error that I believe that Judge Foley made here, Your Honors, is that he used an implied contract theory to exercise his equitable powers. The jury had already decided that there was no breach contract. I mean, those same issues had already been decided. By using the implied contract theory, he brought with him the damages that go with contracts, which is quantum merit, value of the services provided. But in restitution, and that's what the Restatement 155 says, is that the measure of restitution, if we do not have significant fault on the part of the recipient, is the value to the recipient, not the cost to the provider. And I believe that Mike Johnson's invoices were so grossly exaggerated that they're not in the ballpark of what is fair and reasonable anyway. But theoretically, Judge Meyer Henry, the measure of restitution as to... If you were to find that Larson was unjustly enriched, what was he unjustly enriched? He didn't get any more rent for his land. the value of his land did not go up. He really received little or no benefit.
Is there anything different as far as the facts, back to your commentary about the jury's already decided this case on between Johnson and Larson, were there any other different kinds of facts that the trial judge relied on to find an implied contract different from what was presented to the jury?
I don't think so. It was a pretty short hearing. I think it was an hour and a half. I know that Judge Foley allowed me to present the income tax return for Joe Penny that he didn't let me put in front of the jury. And he allowed me to put in testimony of an invoice regarding the drain tile that showed that Johnson was charging 2.5, 3.5 times what other people would have charged. But the significance is this, and it goes to one of my later arguments here, where Judge Foley improperly applied joint several liability in an equity case. That's a contract theory, that's a tort theory. It doesn't work in unjust enrichment cases. Why? Because the unjust enrichment that Bob Larson may have received and the unjust enrichment that Joe Penny may have received are different. Larson didn't get any increase in his land, didn't get any increase in his income, so there really are no restitutional damages. He wasn't unjustly enriched. Penny was able to come up and take rocks that he had not expended money to stockpile. So the argument can be made, okay, he's unjustly enriched. I mean, he wasn't involved in the contract. There isn't an implied contract here, but he got something of value. You have to view unjust enrichment measure of restitution from Joel Penny's perspective. And what is that? He took about 25 loads. He got $1,000 a load. He had an 85% overhead. He had a partner. Joe Penny net profit, about $2,500 on this deal. The measure of damages is what, if any, unjust enrichment occurred to Joel Penny, not what exaggerated gross revenues did Mike Johnson want to claim. He'd already claimed exaggerated gross revenues to the jury on a breach of contract claim. I want to clarify something, Judge Meyer Henry. Joe Penny was also sued for conversion, and the jury also found that he did not convert that property.
I'm asking you kind of a procedural question. This is a clearly very unusual way to handle this case. If there were questions of fact on the equity issue, was there a discussion prior to trial to at least submit those questions of fact to the jury on the equity part of it? I mean, I've never seen this split like this and then try it to the jury and then the judge uses the same facts to try an equity. I've just never... Okay. Well, how did that come about?
If you look at defendant's proposed jury instruction 1 in the file, I proposed, and let me just quickly go over it. If you find that defendant Larson has proved any of his affirmative defenses, you must, A, return a verdict in defendant Larson's favor on the verdict form entitled Verdict for Larson against Johnson on the claim of breach of express contract. And B, you must determine if plaintiff is entitled to a monetary judgment against defendant Larson based on the legal theory of implied contract to prevent defendant Larson from being unduly enriched, defendant Larson receiving services and products from plaintiff of greater value than the rock plaintiff removed from defendant Larson's land. You'll receive later instruction on this. If you find that the plaintiff is entitled to monetary judgment based upon applied contract, you fill out this form. Judge Foley did not want the jury to decide the implied contract action. He believed that that was his job as a judge, that the pattern jury instruction that we have in South Dakota that tells the jury about implied contracts, and I pointed that out to him when we're settling jury instructions. So, but Judge, your decision not to allow this question of implied contract to go to the jury is inconsistent with South Dakota pattern jury instruction, which states right on an implied contract is such and such.
Well, would he have an effect then, Judge Foley, made findings of fact that may have actually been contrary to the findings that the jury found?
Oh, absolutely did. Yes.
And I don't understand that part of it, I guess, how it got to that, because I don't know. I mean, that's very...
Well, see, I think one of the things that you should do to clarify for the bench and bar is whether or not there's a jury trial right in equity matters. I mean, I could put on my hat and argue to you that's a powerful governmental authority that should only be exercised by a judge. But for years, we have allowed juries to be instructed on implied contracts and make all kinds of decisions that are equitable in nature. Judge Foley believed, I mean, this restitutional power that I have as a judge is I merely really should have that. The jury doesn't have an equitable power, so I understand, I mean, he and I visited about the fact that it isn't clear. I think you guys, as the Supreme Court justices, need to clarify for all of us, is there a right to a jury trial in equitable matters? Do implied contracts get jury trials or not? Judge Meyer Henry, had he, Judge Foley, instructed the jury on implied contract, I believe that the jury would have returned the same verdict they did on the express contract, which was, there's no liability here. I mean, Johnson had so substantially breached his contract that it relieved Bob Larson from the responsibility to continue it. Then his inconsistency in his exercise of equitable powers would have been all the more stark in contrast to the decision of the jury, because then it would have had a clear conflict. Because the jury would have decided whether or not there was unjust enrichment. Now, let me just quote you part of a letter that I wrote to Judge Foley when we were working on this issue.
He certainly could have given it to the jury. I mean, I don't think there's anything that prohibits us from giving an equitable question like that to a jury if the judge decides to. But what you're saying is we need to go the next step and say you have a right to it.
Well, my argument for my clients would be it's a constitutional right. I argued to Judge Foley that if he would allow the jury to decide the implied contract theory, he'd have the opinion of 12 people as to whether or not there was unjust enrichment. I believe he was concerned that he would divest himself of his restitutional jurisdiction if he allowed the jury to decide the implied contract, because it was also based on unjust enrichment. But I don't believe that's the case. And that's the Wisconsin cases that I cited to you. I reread those again this morning. I mean, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is saying quantum merit, implied contract, is just one of the mechanisms that a judge can utilize to exercise restitutional authority. The baggage that comes along with using implied contract is you use contract measure of damages. He would have had the power, even if the jury would have decided that there was no implied contract, to say, I don't care if there was no implied contract or not, was somebody unjustly enriched? And if they were unjustly enriched, do I have the legal power in equity to correct that? And the answer would be yes. I don't think having allowed the jury to decide the implied contract theory, Judge Meyer-Henry, would have denied Judge Foley the right to exercise his equitable authority in the area of restitution. Okay. Restatement of Restitution 155, Common A. This rule that the proper measure of restitution is the value to the receiver, not the cost to the giver, if there's significant fault on the part of the giver. They say the rule stated in this section applies where there was no tortious conduct on the part of the recipient. It applies where he was not substantially more at fault than the claimant. It applies where neither party was at fault, where the claimant was at fault and the recipient was not, and the cases where both were at fault in nearly equal degree. So I'm back full circle. Fault has its place in determining what measure of restitution is appropriate. And if the plaintiff was dishonest in his dealings with the other party, if he was dishonest in his presentation to the court, if he substantially contributed to his own injury, then even if those things aren't such dirty hands that it bars him, what it does is it creates the measure of restitution as the value to the recipient, not the cost to the giver. And therein lies Judge Foley's error if you don't find that he erred in not dismissing this initially because of the unclean hands of Mike Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Dorothy.
Thank you.
Mr. Tobin, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Michael Tobin from Sioux Falls from the Boyce Greenfield firm. And it is my honor and privilege to be before this court this morning representing Michael Johnson Construction, a rock, gravel, sand, and aggregate company from the city of Madison. We are before this court this morning asking that this court affirm the trial court's award of equitable relief in this matter. That award needs to be affirmed as, first, none of the circuit court's findings are clearly erroneous. And second, the circuit court's award of equitable relief is not an abuse of discretion.
As to both defendants?
Correct, Your Honor, as to both defendants.
That's where I have a problem, particularly in light of the jury's verdict. Can you explain, how do you let a jury decide whether or not there's a breach of contract and then the judge decide an equitable action based on the exact same facts?
Well, Your Honor, there's many different angles to come at that. I think first, it's completely disingenuous for anyone to stand before this court and try to argue what the jury found.
Well, they found there was no breach of contract. We know that.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree.
It was a
general verdict, and all it merely said was plaintiff entitled to an award on the breach of contract?
Right.
And the jury said no.
And the jury said no.
So, Your Honor, we are now left to guess.
You're telling me that doesn't mean that the jury found that there wasn't a breach of contract?
Your Honor, I'm saying we don't know. The jury was instructed on numerous affirmative defenses.
Tell me what it means, then.
Well, the jury was instructed on numerous affirmative defenses. The jury may well have found that one of those affirmative defenses was at play. I would respectfully...
Give me a detail on what you mean. That's a generality, but I... Tell me what you mean. What affirmative defense would have caused this jury verdict, and that I couldn't conclude from looking at it that the jury found that there was no breach of contract?
One of those affirmative defenses, Your Honor, was estoppel. I do not believe that there would be anything inconsistent with the jury adopting an estoppel affirmative defense and then not concluding that there was a breach of the contract. And that's the frustration here. If these affirmative defenses and if the appellants wanted to apply jury findings into the equitable realm, they should have suggested that to the trial court.
Okay, then I'll follow up with another question. As far as the equitable relief, what facts were different there, or were there any different facts presented to the court on the equitable claim than was presented to the jury?
We had a separate hearing that lasted a couple hours, Your Honor, where there was some additional evidence received. But I would concede to you that the bulk of the evidence was the same. Whether that's, you know, I would say it's probably 90 to 95% of the evidence was in fact the same.
Doesn't this set amazing precedent that if you come to the jury on a breach of contract, you've sent it to the jury rules against your client, now you get another bite of the apple with an equitable claim?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree that it sets a bad precedent or that it's another bite of the apple. And I think this point is very important. One of the primary defenses that the appellants had at trial is a vigorous attack on our damages for the breach of contract and the conversion. That was a major, major defense theme throughout this case. At the breach of contract conversion part of the case, we requested about $85,000 from the jury. That represented what we believe to be our net profit on the rocks that were taken that my client couldn't sell.
And would that have been an express contract that you were arguing or an implied contract?
I think that's an excellent point, Your Honor. At the very beginning of trial, before the jury selection had even begun, Judge Foley took us into chambers and asked us that very question. He said, "Counsel, are we trying an implied contract case here or an express contract case here?" Both Mr. Dorothy and I said, "It's an express contract case." Both clients agreed that there wasn't an agreement, and that's how they all testified.
But it wasn't for the damages that you sued for. The agreement was quid pro quo, and I'd do this and relay the tile and take the rocks away and dig them out, and in exchange, I mean, that there was not the vouchers. The agreement was not that they were going to pay Johnson X amount of money, right?
Correct. There was never an agreement that they would be paid X amount of money. My client's payment for both the 960 feet of drain tile and the month of working and removing those rocks, over 1,100 tons of those rocks, was the rock. Now, Mr. Dorothy wants to say that these rocks were a nuisance to someone. Well, as we all know, someone's nuisance is someone else's treasure. These rocks have incredible value, and that was the carrot, the inducement for my client to agree to do this, to agree to mobilize several heavy pieces of equipment that have to be transported on trucks, that to go to a field several miles away to spend a month there with three other of his employees working in a literal mud hole. That was the inducement. And that's what we asked the jury for. Pay us for those rocks.
And the jury ruled against you.
You're correct, Your Honor. And then I don't believe there's anything inconsistent then with saying, okay, the jury ruled against us. We don't know why. We don't know why the jury ruled against us, but they did. We are obviously stuck with that fact. We disagree with that, but we have to accept it. But we do not believe there's anything then inconsistent with turning around and asking the court, and it was there from the very beginning, Your Honor. From the very moment this lawsuit began, we had legal claims and we had equitable claims. They were there. We do not believe there's then anything inconsistent with then asking the court in light of the jury's verdict, okay, can we please now have our out-of-pocket expenses back on an unjust enrichment theory? And under the facts as found by the trial court agreed. To award equitable relief, the court has to make three findings. My client would have to prove three things. Number one, was a benefit conferred? Two, awareness. Was the party receiving that benefit? Were they aware of receiving a benefit? And three, is it inequitable for that person to retain that benefit without paying for it?
How do you distinguish our holding in Birch versus Bricker, where we said that a claim for unjust enrichment is unwarranted when the rights of the parties are controlled by an express contract?
Well, Your Honor, I think the Birch case goes a little bit further than that. First, it also says that the express contract has to fully set forth the rights of the parties. I think that's one important distinguishment. Here, there's no way this quick oral agreement of, I got rocks, come get them, you can have them. That doesn't fully set forth the rights of the parties. As to duration, the timing, where these rocks are supposed to go, lots of issues were left up in the air. So I think that alone distinguishes it. But also, and Justice Zinter authored that opinion, Justice Zinter also made clear that the express right contract needs to be in writing, which we certainly do not have here. This was a oral agreement, pure and simple.
But you did agree with the trial judge, both sides, that this was an express agreement.
Correct, Your Honor. It's an express agreement, and as the jury was instructed, an express agreement can be created orally. And we don't disagree with that. As the parties testified, they had this agreement. It's very general. It's very superficial. But it's not unlike a lot of contracts that a lot of South Dakotans enter into every single day. If you come here and do this, I'll give you X. That's what this contract was. That's an express agreement, but there's no way we can say that it fully sets forth the rights of the parties. And that's why I would say that the Burt case would not apply.
Or was it inadequate? As I understand it, there was the oral agreement covered all the relevant terms that were tried to the jury.
I don't know, Your Honor, if it covered all the terms. What a big issue at trial with the jury was duration. There was disagreement. My client understood that he could leave these rocks in this pasture and this garbage pit area by Mr. Larson's house indefinitely. That's what he testified to. Mr. Larson testified that no, he always assumed that Mr. Johnson would come back sooner or later and get them. So as to that key issue of duration, there never was an agreement or a meeting of the minds as to that issue.
Haven't we said, though, that a general verdict resolves all issues presented to the jury. We can't, I don't think we've ever said that when a jury comes back with a general verdict, since we don't know exactly what they decided, we can retry those same issues in an equity court.
Your Honor, I would agree with you that a general verdict would resolve the issues tried to the jury. And we're not before this court arguing breach of contract or conversion. We lost. We don't like it, but we accept it. But the equitable claims asked very different questions, and the damages sought were very different. From our perspective, it's almost an apples and an oranges perspective. We are not trying to get a second bite of the apple. We had to prove, instead of a contract and consideration and breach, or in the issues of conversion of proprietary interest that was interfered with, we didn't have to do that anymore. We lost that. We instead had to show, was a benefit conferred? Were Mr. Larson and Mr. Penny aware of receiving it? And is it inequitable for them to retain that benefit without paying for it? Very different questions, Your Honor. And the damages are also very different. The jury, we asked for about $85,000, which we thought would be our net profit for the rocks. We lost that. In the equitable side, we're merely asking for our out-of-pocket expenses, our time and labor. And that came to roughly $33,000.
But that $85,000 you asked for included the expenses, right? That wasn't just profit. That was the profit and the expenses.
It was as to the conversion element, it was not, Your Honor. Because under the conversion, you get the value of the item converted at the time
it was
converted.
Right, but I'm talking about on your breach of contract claim, did your client put in evidence in front of the jury what it cost him to extract those rocks?
Sure. The jury certainly knew those invoices, exhibits 2 and 3, that Judge Foley used. He trimmed some time off of those for his equitable award. But yes, those were presented to the jury. So the jury was aware of what it took by time and machinery to harvest those rocks and install the drain tile. So, Your Honors, from our perspective, the key issue on this appeal is it inequitable to have Mr. Larson and Mr. Penny pay for what they received? And here, I think that answer is clearly no. First, while the appellants want to assail my client and come before this court and accuse him of being a scoundrel and dishonest, he's unfortunately stuck with the trial court's findings, which he must somehow convince were clearly erroneous, which, of course, he cannot do. The circuit court found that unclean hands did not apply. The circuit court found that some time needed to be trimmed from those invoices. But the reason for that was rather straightforward. The circuit court trimmed off some time that was there for some routine maintenance and cleaning of the equipment. The circuit court didn't transform that into some sort of fraudulent invoice. And importantly, and this came out at trial, and it's in the transcript at page 406 to 428, my client actually underbilled Mr. Larson by 48 hours. That's undisputed. Underbilled him by 48 hours. And I would ask that this court keep this in mind as we're trying to weigh these issues of unclean hands and whether my client's a good guy or not.
Let's talk a little bit about the claim against Mr. Penny alone. Now, Mr. Penny was sued for conversion, is that right?
He was, Your Honor.
So the jury resolved that issue against your client.
Correct.
As to Mr. Penny, but there were still the restitution issues, and Mr. Darthy argues that the judge used the wrong measure of damages, the cost to your client as opposed to the measure of what the value was to Mr. Penny of these rocks.
Correct.
What's your response to that?
Well, I have two responses. First, Your Honor, I think Mr. Darthy needs to be careful what he's arguing, because as found by the circuit court, the circuit court found that Mr. Penny realized a net profit of $38,117. So he has to be careful, because to get out from underneath of that finding, he has to show it's clearly erroneous, which I would submit he cannot do. So we need to be careful that he knows what he's asking for.
But what measure of damages did the trial court use?
The trial court used the measure of damages as enunciated by this court. It's the labor and materials. That comes from the Karras case and also the Caldwell case. Two different opinions from this court where time and materials are used. We also cite, Your Honor, to the American Jurisprudence on Restitution, 66 Amjur 2nd, restitution section 37. We've got the secondary source that also indicates that when you're in restitution in quantum merit, the measure of damages is the time and services provided.
But this is quantum merit and unjust enrichment are two different theories. They can't be used interchangeably. We're talking here about not about quantum merit, we're talking about unjust enrichment. And doesn't unjust enrichment have a different measure of damages?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that I think there is some confusion there, and especially under the Hofelt case and the Karras case, where it talks about quantum merit being a vehicle to provide restitution to prevent unjust enrichment. We almost get all three of those terms in one sentence.
So maybe we're guilty of creating some confusion then too, huh?
Well, I'm not going to sit here and accuse the court of being guilty of anything.
You always have to get one more chance to get it right.
Well, and that very well may be true, Your Honor. But I would submit, Your Honor, as for the measurement of damages, we followed what this court has said. The other side, they want to follow different things from the restatement, and that's fine, but that's not what this court has said. So certainly I don't think Judge Foley or my client can be faulted for using the measure of damages articulated by this court. So, Your Honor, I want to touch on a couple of the issues that the court addressed with Mr. Dorothy. I also think we need to be careful. We throw around this term implied contract, and I think we need to make sure we're talking about it in its proper context. There is an implied contract that someone can sue on for breach of contract. It's set forth in the code, and an implied contract is one that's through conduct and behavior as opposed to words or oral or written. You can have an implied contract that you can sue on that contract. That's one thing. And that is what these jury instructions that Mr. Dorothy referenced were about. And that's what Judge Foley talked about at the beginning of the trial. Are we trying an implied contract or an express? Now, it's unfortunate that these same words are used, but it's a very different concept. When we go to equity, and when we talk about the law implying a contract here, that's a very different concept from this implied contract where someone can sue on the contract. The implied contract in the equitable realm, it really accomplishes that legal fiction of saying, no, because this is inequitable, we're going to require someone to pay something back. So I just want to make sure that we're clear that this implied contract, while it surfaces in this case in two different contexts, the contexts for those surfacings are very important. And lastly, Your Honors, I also want to address, there was this issue raised by Mr. Dorothy that my client somehow was asked to return to the job site. I just want to address that again and state there's no evidence to that. In fact, the evidence is that my client and Mr. Larson never communicated ever again from the moment my client left on April 15th of 2005 until my client sent him the letter after discovering the rocks were gone in October of 2006. They never communicated, ever. And I think that's very important. Now, Mr. Dorothy tried to put on testimony from an employee of my client, former at the time of trial, and a friend of his, that they talked about it. But I think it's important, I impeached him at trial, because during his deposition, the employee said he never spoke to my client about it. So I think that's important to keep in mind. My client spent a month in a virtual mud hole with large pieces of equipment, with four employees, and they worked on it nonstop, installing 960 feet of drain tile and removed 1,100 tons of rock. Why? My client saw the value in that rock and wanted it. That was his inducement to do this. Then, unbeknownst to him, without advance warning, it disappears. Now, it's somewhat difficult to think about rocks like this, but if we turn this into corn or hay bales or coal, maybe then the injustice here comes to the surface a little bit more powerfully. My client spent a month working there. There's no question he did the work. The drain tile is installed. 1,100 tons of rock have been removed and sold by Mr. Penny on the market. So those benefits that have been conferred, they were. So the question is it unjust or inequitable for them not to pay for it? And I would submit that Judge Foley's decision was not an abuse of discretion. He merely brought my client back to even. That's all he did. Just gave him back his out-of-pocket expenses. My client's back to even. The drain tile's still there, the rocks are still gone, and Mr. Penny still has the profit from selling them. So we would respectfully request, Your Honors, that this court affirm that decision because the factual findings are not clearly erroneous and the equitable award was not an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tobin. Mr. Dorothy, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Judge Meyerheimer, you asked the question, what affirmative defense? I mean, give me a specific affirmative defense that might have caused this jury to make their decision they did. Well, one was the instruction that if a plaintiff substantially, materially breaches a contract, the defendant is relieved from any further responsibility to continue it. I mean, that's well-established law. They were instructed on that. But the bottom line of your question remains, which is the jury did decide that there was no breach of contract. Either, well, it wasn't because it wasn't a contract, because Bob Larson always agreed. We agreed to those things. So the jury said one of those affirmative defenses stuck, and I don't think it was estoppel myself. I think it was the simple decision of 12 people saying, you know, the guy never came back and got the rocks. But he never finished the job, and he left it in a mess. Now, clarify something. Tim Basler is an employee of Mike Johnson's. He introduced Mike Johnson to Bob Larson. Knew Bob had a bunch of rock. Knew that Mike wanted rock. After they had extracted and worked there, extracted rock, pile rock, haul rock, and spring came, it's time for Johnson's guys to go back to the rock pits and make gravel and do that sort of thing. In the middle of the summer, Bob Larson asked Tim Basler, would you talk to Johnson and see when he's going to come back? Basler said, I talked to Johnson. He says, well, I'm too busy right now. To say that there was no direct contact between Larson and Johnson about when he was going to come back ignores the law of agency. This was his employee. When the next year, after Joe Penny has contacted him and said, well, I've heard that you got a bunch of rock on your place you'd like to have removed. I said, well, I had a deal with this guy in Madison. He's going to come and get all this stuff. I better go in and see him and find out whether or not he's going to do that. He drives in and talks to the man's secretary. Says, would you please have a guy call me and tell me what his intentions are? No, he did not. Bob Larson did not personally talk to Mike Johnson, but twice in two different years, through employees, he asked the very clear question, when are you going to come back and finish the job? I think most likely, Judge Meyerheimer, that the jury said he so substantially breached this contract by not coming back and finishing the job in a timely fashion that Mr. Larson didn't have any more obligation under that contract. That's probably what their decision was. Now, I read with interest this morning. I'm trying to, you know, get ready to give you guys as good an argument as I can on these issues and anticipate some of your questions. These two Wisconsin Supreme Court cases that I cited to you, Franks versus Lockwood and Fuller versus Cedar. Let me just take Fuller versus Cedar and see if it can help clarify some of the issues for us. There was a fill done on land that was being developed. The lessee lost the lease, and now the landlord takes over, and he's received the benefit of the fill on his land. The judge gave the entity doing the filling a judgment based on quantum merit. That's an implied contract measure of damages. The appellate court reversed it and said, this was not a proper measure of damages because this wasn't an implied contract. There was no contract between the landlord and the guy that filled in the tenant's property, but there may have been unjust enrichment. I mean, the landlord may have got something of value, but we don't use a contract measure of damages in an unjust enrichment matter. What was the value to the landowner? So they reversed the judge, and they distinguish between contracts implied in law and contracts implied in fact. And I'm struggling with those concepts. Say, how can we simplify for the judges and lawyers what these implied contract things are? The reality is that implied contract cases are nothing more than the exercise of restitutional equitable powers in the form that we're familiar with, which is contract law. In reality, the restitutional powers exceed implied contract. I believe that you could have a jury make a decision in a particular case, and yet the judge look at that and say, you know, the law was applied and the jury did what they were supposed to do, but that's, I mean, it's really unfair. It's really not right. I have the authority to exercise unjust enrichment principles to change this. But it does get so close to reversing the jury verdict and ensuring a lack of respect for the jury verdict. I think that it would be very helpful if this court could clarify implied contract, whether or not you have a right to a jury trial, and whether or not, even if the jury finds that there's no implied contract, does the judge have the power in restitution and equity to prevent unjust enrichment?
Right. Mr. Dorothy, you're talking about unjust enrichment and implied contract or quantum merit with regard to Mr. Penny. And okay. I believe you said there's a question of unjust enrichment. What's the measure of damages?
Well, the measure of damages is what net profit did Joe Penny make from any rocks that he got. And I, for the life of me, do not know where Judge Foley came up with a $38,000 figure. What I have is the tax return of 1 year of the rock operation of Joe, and I have an income and expense statement for the prior year, and in each instance, Judge Severson, his overhead was about 85%. We have 25 loads of rock at $1,000 a load, and 85% of that was overhead. He had a partner, Gatewood, that was a one-half partner in this thing. He hasn't been sued. So Joe Penny's value that he received is about $2,500 in net profits. I have no idea how you come up with $38,000. Now, well, the only way you get there is ignore the fact that even in breach of contract cases, you're not entitled to gross revenue, you're only entitled to net profits. But $38,000 isn't even a net profit. So I don't know where that figure came from.
Mr. Tobin's saying you better be careful about what you ask for, because if that's what the trial court said was the value that he received, and you're arguing that he should be, that if there's any damages at all against Mr. Penny, it should be that measure. Are you saying now? I'm saying
that Judge Foley's signing off on findings of fact and conclusions of law that my opponent sent him, saying that there's $38,000 in damages, is not supported by the facts of this case. It's not supported by the income tax return.
But that isn't the measure of damages he used, is it? I thought he used the measure for quantum merit, which was the value to your client, the value to Mr. Johnson, the cost.
I agree. And
okay.
Judge, as I think these things through and I hear us talk and I listen to Mr. Tobin make his presentations, we have this merging and then separation of implied contracts, contract theories, equity theories, and that's why I say we really could use some assistance from the bar's perspective is to An implied contract, does that continue to be a restitutional or equity power that a judge has? It probably should. Then is there a jury trial right to that? Find that out for us. But separate, in our minds, the fact that quantum merit and implied contract and restitutional powers are not synonymous. They are different. They are separate. Implied contract is simply one mechanism of carrying out unjust enrichment prevention authority. I want to thank you for allowing me to come and give you a presentation. Obviously, something intrigued you about this case, and I haven't been here in a good number of years, so it's been very interesting and challenging. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dorothy. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.